I will actually be talking about something for a long time I made fun of, which is the problem of time in quantum gravity. And I think finally I convinced myself that it was important. It was not just metaphysics. I'm going to be relating that with something which indeed I've worked on a lot, which is the problem of the constants of nature. I think the two things are probably very closely related. If you kind of close your eyes, you might think, well, shouldn't something which is constant or meant to be constant be the quantum complementary of something which is change, which is time? So it's very easy to get immediately carried away with words if you start playing these games of words. So that's basically what I will be talking about. Let's see if this works. It does. So the background, I don't need to say much to this crowd without dwelling too much on the philosophy of the problem. The problem of time arises because of the Hamiltonian constraint in quantum gravity being zero. So time there is actually coordinate time, one should qualify that. And the fact that the Hamiltonian is zero because the theory should be a time reparametrization invariant means the time drops out of something which potentially could be a Schrodinger equation. So this is not very nice, particularly if you consider that then observables should not be time dependent, should commit to the Hamiltonian. So you end up with a picture of the world in which there's no evolution in the world. And people have taken very different views on this, which roughly speaking, align themselves with the Greek philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, if you want to be a bit simplistic about the matter. So some people actually take the view that, well, if this is what theory implies, then it must be true. And in fact, time as we perceive it might be an illusion in the cave, in this Platonic cave of sorrows we are unlucky enough to inhabit. So that's one way to look at the problem of time. Time drops out of the theory. Maybe time is an illusion. It's really not something which is peculiar, which is a feature of the real world. It's just some kind of illusion. Of course, you can also take the other view, which I would say is the more experimental view or Aristotelian view, which is you always mix the two things. It's true that the senses do cheat on us sometimes a little bit, but they can't deceive us that much. So if you have a theory which predicts something so obviously, so blatantly in contradiction with a fact of life, then something is wrong with the theory. Okay, so it's a different attitude, and you might say, well, no wonder quantum gravity is usually banished to the Planck epoch, which you can translate into the realms of bullshit. So in one case, you put time in the realms of the caves of Plato, the other one, you just say it's quantum gravity, that's complete nonsense. Okay, so it's basically two attitudes you can take. It's a bit simplistic, but I think I do think you need time to make contact with the real world. And part of the problem of quantum gravity and it being such a failure in terms of phenomenology may actually be related to this. I mean, we don't really have a time. Obviously, coordinate time is meaningless. We need something like a relational time, a physical time. And this is not new. I'm just reviewing a common problem. And the problem is then, of course, that then you end up with an embarrassment of riches. You end up with too many times if you start going relational. Is that okay? Well, some people might argue that no, it's not okay. There should be just one time. Other people don't mind. And I think I will defend the second camp here, the second approach. I mean, I will argue, in fact, that not only is it okay to have many times, but it might be a feature of the physical world we live in, a bit like different time zones. You go to different regions of a space, we have different times. And the process of adjusting your clocks when you go from one time zone to another, it's just a fact of life. And there is nothing necessarily contradictory in that. What might actually happen is that you may end up with new phenomenology. And that's good because it could be testable. So it could be actually a feature which is non-conventional, but which actually affects the predictivity of the theory. So what I'm going to be doing is actually combining these with something which has been my breadwinner in a way, which is trying to play with the constants of nature. And so I'm not going to go much into that. This all comes back to a paper Dirac wrote during his honeymoon in 1937 in Brighton. He asked the question, why are the constants what they are? Why do they take the values they take? Why are they constant? And that's a big topic. But basically, the proposal in this talk is that indeed, as I suggested with the game of words, when I started, time, I'm going to be looking at time as a conjugate of the constants of nature. So I will actually build a theory from the classical theory to the quantum theory. I'm not sure this is the best way to do these things, but I will be following that usual route, in which case I'm actually claiming that time is the canonical conjugate in the Hamiltonian sense of the constants of nature. So certainly I will imply that quantum mechanically, they should be complementary. If you know the constants well, you don't know time. If you know time well, you don't know the constants. They are like position and momentum in a way. So one thing which is important is that if I do take the view this is classically a feature, not just a quantum mechanical feature, then constants will appear as constants of motion rather than constants set in stone. Okay, so it's very important. This is really kind of a different way to look at constants. They will be side by side with the other constants of motion. And this is important for a much bigger question. So in fact, this is something Lee and I have discussed for a very long time. Is there evolution in the universe? Are the laws of physics something which changes? What told the universe, what the laws are? Is the universe making it up as it goes along? So he says, this goes back to the John Wheeler idea, in fact, that everything comes out of higgledy-piggledy, as he put it. Even if it's not that chaotic, it could be that the universe makes it up as it goes along. And in fact, there's this very interesting paper, which I don't quite understand, combining, I'm sure the authors don't understand it either, but that's okay. I think it's such a combination of different topics, including computer science and so on, that it would be surprising if everyone understood everything completely. Could the universe be teaching the laws of itself? Could the laws be evolving? So this is something which has intrigued me for a long time, and I'm sure Lee is another person who's intrigued by this. I think I've come to realize recently is that if you're going to entertain the idea of time dependence in the laws of physics, then you'd better know what physical time is in the first place. So I think somehow we may have been misguided in some of the attempts to put time in the dependence or time dependence in the laws of physics by not addressing the issue of the problem of time in the first place. So this is just the background. Any questions? I can see John Moffat. No. Okay. So if there's any questions, just raise your hand and mute yourself and ask questions. This will never be as vocal as normally it is in person, but we can try and shout a bit. Okay, so this is my roadmap. I'm going to be basically be following. Oh, I see what happened. I just touched the wrong button. That's why you're appearing now suddenly. So this is the roadmap of what I'm going to be doing. I mean, this obviously is not completely new. I'm going to be starting off by giving you some background. And the background is basically unimodular gravity, in which the constant to be targeted is the cosmological constant. So in a way, you can see what I'm about to say as a generalization of that work. Interestingly enough, it will actually connect with quite different work to do with the Chern-Simons state, much maligned in some quarters. I'm going to be trying to rehabilitate the Chern-Simons state. Once you look at it the right way, in fact, it's the right way to look at the problem of time in unimodular gravity. I will try and convince you of that. So this is the background, and essentially then I'll explain how I will be going through. Let me start just with the background and then I will give you the proposal. Okay, so background. This kind of idea appears most poignantly, I should say, in a unimodular gravity. When you take an action, which could be anything, it could be the Einstein-Hilbert action with the cosmological constant, could be anything, and you add to it a term like this. Can you see my arrow? Put the things up. Okay, good.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. You're pointing, you never know what actually appears in people's screens. Is this big enough, by the way? I could do much at this stage.
For me, this is good, yeah.
Because normally things appear as huge on the screen and now we never know what's going to be. Well, if you're looking at your phone, they're probably too small, but then you shouldn't be looking at these in your phone. Okay, so what I was saying, I will be doing this in mini space later on. Let me discuss the thing in general here. So you basically end up with the usual action you have, and you add to it something, So this is a way to deconstantize the cosmological constant. You just multiply it by this divergence. So there's no square root of minus g here, important, which means that this thing is actually covariant by virtue of this t, which appears here being a density. So this is actually covariant, but it's covariant because, well, lambda is a scalar, t mu is going to be a density. So what happens now is, of course, you vary the action with respect to this t mu, this new variable, which appears there, and you end up with a constancy of lambda. There's an equation of motion, so no longer is lambda set in stone, the thing Dirac hated, and the thing which started the field of varying constants, et cetera, et cetera. So now it still is a constant, but it just is a circumstantial constant. So quite different. Now, if you look at the zero component of that vector t mu, that density t mu, you find that actually this thing, which is the canonical conjugate of the constant, which has been demoted from being a set in stone constant, this thing provides a great definition of time. And in fact, you end up with a time formula. So to use like the Greenwich observatory terminology, which is if you now do the opposite, if you now, so now lambda is of course a equation, is a variable. So you know, if you now vary the action with respect to this, then you end up exactly with an expression for your T zero, which looks like an equation for time, a relational time. And this turns out to be Meissner volume time in this particular case. So this is quite old. It's something which goes back to the 80s, late 80s. And it was known in the context of unimodular gravity, basically. Great story. What I'm going to be doing is proposing to do this to every other constant of nature that is useful. And I'll tell you what I mean by useful. So the same kind of procedure, I'm going to be applying these to constants, which, you know, pick your constant, do the same and see what happens. And more to the point, pick the constant which is most relevant to the dynamics in a given region of phase space, in a given epoch in time, whatever, in the epoch of the life of the universe. Pick the constant that's dominant, which is clearly not lambda origin in the early universe, now it is, and just apply the same kind of effective procedure. So we end up with a time formula again. So the constants again arise as equations of motion, and their canonical momentum arise as times. And of course, classically, they're all equivalent because they all will end up being a redefinition of the Laplace function. But the question is, when I do the quantum mechanics of this theory, are they going to be really equivalent? So this is really what I want to do. This is the background for what I want to do. The background too is something which you might think is a bit unrelated, but in fact it is quite closely related. And it's the idea of doing quantum gravity in connection space. So this is kind of, instead of using the metric, let's use the connection. I'm not saying anything controversial in this community, except I'm dropping the loops, okay? I don't need the loop representation. I'm just going straight to the connection, I think.
May I ask something? So, yeah. So you introduce these times as vector fields. You don't impose their integrability, or you do? Because yeah, for time, I would think I want like functions. Yeah, like I want to integrate these vectors to be able to build some kind of foliation of space time, no?
Yes, in fact, I'm going to be doing this in mini superspace exactly to avoid that kind of problem.
Right, but in general, the solutions of these equations, they are not integrable, right? Fields.
I think quite often, what I'm going to be doing in the end is just completely, it's an effective time. So I'm not surprised time is disappearing. Time is not going to be fundamental, it's going to be emergent. And if it disappears in some situations, I don't care.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, but I'm more thinking about like kinematics of time that you suggest. So these are really like vectors for you, not foliations. Not space-time foliations.
Well, they can be, right? Depends on the situation, right?
And
depends.
That can be, but it doesn't seem to be generic situation.
No. Nothing here is fundamental or generic, and I don't apologize for that. So, okay. Okay. Any more questions? Oh, this is like the old perimeter. You know, that's good.
Yes, I have a question.
Okay.
It's generally accepted that unimodular gravity does not solve the cosmological constant problem.
I'm not going to be solving the cosmological constant problem.
Okay, so yeah. That's still a problem, whatever.
No. I mean, I think in fact, we could discuss that. I'm not going to be trying to do that, no. Anything else? This is a good place to. This is all background. You know, I've made a state of intention. I mean, well, an intention. I've explained clearly what I'm about to do, but I haven't done anything yet. Okay, second bit is, so this is a thing which you might think is anachronic, and I'll explain. You should not call me anachronic too soon because you'll be insulting lots of people. You can insult me as much as you wish, but you probably don't want to insult some of the people I will mention in a minute. You will be indirectly doing that. So let's imagine you do gravity in the connection representation, but without the loops and without complexifying the theory. So, I mean, I don't care about the fact that SO3,1 has got two irreducible representations, SU2s, I don't care. I just make sure I do everything in real variables, I avoid all this problem with reality conditions and blah, blah, blah. I have a real theory, okay? So then it is well known that without the loops, you can actually find something which I call the real Kodama state, which is a Kodama state without putting complex Hall's terms and things like that, which actually is obtained from the usual one, which I wrote here, with this replacement. So instead of having the Chern-Simons functional, you have the imaginary part of this Chern-Simons functional, so that this exponential becomes a plane wave. So the usual pathologies disappear, and this was widely known. I didn't discover any of these. So these are the references of papers which I think very unfairly have been ignored, pointing this out. And this also makes contact with an idea Lee Smolin and Chopin Su had a few years ago about time being exactly this imaginary part of the Chern-Simons function. So this is the kind of thing I will be making contact with, but in a more general setting. Let me say that if you think this is a bit strange, let me tell you that it's actually very outlandish for cosmologists to use the metric, to use the connection as the normal variable. For whatever reason, people tend to think of the cosmological main variable as the expansion factor. Well, I'm asking you for a description in terms of B, not A, expansion factor, but B, something which is the component of the Ashtekar self-dual connection, if you want, but without making it necessarily complex in a complex theory. So this thing is basically on shell A dot. So you have to think in terms of momentum instead of position, but who knows what the main variable is? And I would say that the main variable in cosmology should be this guy, B, not A. Come to think of it, it's not so outlandish. You might think of this as the Kamuving Hubble scale. So the Hubble is basically A dot over A. Kamuving is A dot, right? So the inverse of that is basically this variable, which is responsible, as you know, for the horizon problem. Now, this is the kind of thing which I was giving a lecture. Now you ask everyone to put the hand up who agrees with this or not. Okay, let's see. So maybe it is outlandish. And the test case is, are we experiencing a bounce at the moment? So in fact, normally think of bounces in A. In fact, we are experiencing a bounce in B. Because remember, B is something which was increasing and now it's decreasing because we started accelerating effectively. So we have just recently changed the sign of B. So in a way, if you think in terms of B instead of terms of A, a lot of your intuitions get mixed around. So funnily enough, if you have inflation, when you stop inflation, you have a bounce in B. If you have a radiation and matter dominated universe, which then has a lambda that resurfaces, then you have a bounce in B, okay? So funnily enough, we just come out of a bounce in connection space. So be very careful when you say this is anachronic, it may be unusual, but in fact, there's nothing wrong with using one variable or another. In fact, they're just complementaries. And in fact, when you say the Chern-Simons state is anachronic, what you're saying is that the dual, which is the Hartle-Hawking wave function, with the Wilenkin wave functions are anachronic because they're exactly the same. So I'm gonna be using the connection representation because it will be easier later on. But bear in mind, there's two enemy families here, the metric family and the connection family. They really hang exactly the same. So this is your action, this is your conjugates. And you know, they're basically, you can have a B representation or an A representation. So this is your Chern-Simons state in the B representation. But there is a Fourier transform, obviously, between one and the other, and it is indeed what you get. If you Fourier transform the Chern-Simons state, you get the Wilenkin were the Hartle-Hawking wave functions, depending on how you do the contours. Okay, so I'm going to be using the B representation, but bear this in mind. I talked to Alex Vilenkin quite a lot. He was very surprised by these. I don't think anyone knew these. But two enemy families, well, in fact, I don't want to play the United Nations here, but somehow it's the same thing, okay? And of course, there's always a price to make two enemy families talk to each other. The price here, which I think is important to stress before I'm moving on, is that actually there are assumptions, obviously. And the assumption there is that the A square and the B being conjugate means both the A square and the B should run from minus infinity to plus infinity. So we're not imposing the A to be positive, not even the A square to be positive, to be able to play this game, which means there will be Euclidean regions, okay? If you revert back to the metric representation, everything I'm about to say will have Euclidean regions. Okay, so this is the background. Now let me finally, like half an hour in, jump into the actual proposal, which I will illustrate in mini-super space. So as I said, this is based on unimodular gravity and the Chern-Simons state, but the idea, this is not fundamental. I've already clarified that to that very good question. All I want is to start with something which does not have a time. So this is a very dispiriting constraint. And I want to look at regions of parameter space where this holds true approximately, at least for some regions, some epochs, some occasions. This is not fundamental, it's an effective, it's an emergent time. I want this to be true. There is a constant alpha in terms of which this H becomes this. And this alpha could be different in different regions. And it's even possible that in the same region, I have an option of different alphas, okay, for this to be true. Well, then let me kind of just illustrate this. I already gave you some ideas about the general procedure with unimodular gravity.
Sorry, Jacques, can you go back for a second?
Yeah.
So when you mean different alphas in different regions, does this mean different cosmological constants or does this mean?
No. It means different constants.
Okay, so it could be any constant, you say.
Yeah, it could be the gravitational constant, could be the speed of light, could be whatever you want, could be like things like the integration constants of fluids. I'll give you examples in a bit.
Okay, thanks.
So there's only going to be one lambda anyway, yeah, mm-hmm. Okay? And it's not what I'm saying. So it's mimicking the procedure in unimodular gravity, but it does not need to be with lambda, okay?
Mm-hmm. But then is this Hamiltonian or what is this H?
It's a Hamiltonian, yeah. I'm going to be giving you an example just around the corner, just next transparency. People say the best questions are the ones that lead to the next transparency. The next slide, thank you. There you are, this is it. So this is part of it I already introduced before. Let me kind of, this is a busy slide when I put everything in. Okay, Nyayesh, you stay there, Nyayesh, you want to be useful. Okay, so this is, okay, first of all, what is this? So this is the A square I mentioned, that's the metric variable that comes out of this density tries inverse triad in quantum gravity. The B is the thing which is this commoving Hubble volume inverted, so the A dot on shell. So this is the Hamiltonian, right? This guy here. And so first of all, let's see. So this is the lapse function N. There's a reason why this is just the zero gravitational constant, fixed one. I need to fix this one because if I promote the gravitational constant to a variable, I don't want this to affect the commutation relations between variables. I could do that, but then it'd be more complicated. So let me just start doing this. So this is what I already said. The K is the flatness or curvature of the universe. Nyayesh, this is exactly your cosmological constant. So this term here, this summation is going to embody all the different things I can have here. But then I can have the other ones. I can have, for example, dust and radiation. These guys could be the integration constants that come from the fluids, or it could be the actual coupling. So it could be the gravitational coupling. And here, if you want, it could be different gravitational couplings for different kinds of matter. In fact, there's no reason. But one important thing here, just to make this simple, is to make sure this Gn here is not the one that appears there. Because then it's just a different story. It's much more complicated. Okay, there's other options for a massless scalar field. Yeah, I mean, some people use relational time, could be the scalar field and the momentum of the scalar field. So this is an example in which you would end up with an embarrassment of riches in the same region, right? So it could be in this case that, you know, this time here and this time there coexist. Or it could be even these crazy things. I mean, if I put the C squares back in all these various things, the target constant could be the speed of light square, should need to vary between minus infinity and plus infinity. So this is even crazier than a negative speed of light, with an imaginary speed of light in some regimes, and then different equations of state. So many different options here, and notice that with this kind of situation, there are epochs in which one of these constants dominates the dynamics and the other ones are irrelevant. Okay, so then what we do. So this is what I normally do here, and this is an aside, I will mention this later on. So you don't need to do this, but normally you can manipulate your Hamiltonian into something which actually takes this form, okay? So not only we'll have, the thing will spit out one constant, but in particular, I can put a Hamiltonian in this format. And in fact, these are the expressions here for one ingredient I dominating the dynamics. With this guy here, this equation of state to be treated separately. Okay, then let's apply to this the prescription I gave you to these alphas. So this is in mini superspace, the expression. Okay, so I end up with this momentum conjugate to all these variables alpha, the same way in unimodular gravity, I had the same thing for lambda. Okay, so here you would actually pick one over lambda. You'll see why, but it's just a canonical transformation, not a big deal. Okay, you do this, and first thing that happens is exactly you mimic in a Hamiltonian formulation what happens in general in unimodular gravity, which as the constants are constant as an equation of motion. So here they're only constant in time, and they're constant in time because the Hamiltonian does not depend on the momenta conjugate to the constants, which is given I'm going to promote these momenta to times, it's one example of time independence. So it's not coordinate time independence, but it's physical time independence. So this is one thing I'm not going to be doing here, but to go back to this discussion I've had with Lee for years about evolution, if you want to put time inside the Hamiltonian, it should not be coordinate time, it should be this time. So if you're going to be doing something crazy, make sure it's totally crazy, not just a bit crazy, okay? Right, so what happens? You do this and you immediately become the proud owner of not only a time, but a Schrodinger equation. So what before was dispiriting H equals zero, now becomes this H zero here, and this alpha here becomes this time operator. And it's only when you impose a monochromatic solution of this format that you end up with a Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is timeless. And you should not be surprised by this, because of course, what you're saying is that if I fix the conjugate of time completely, then I become completely delocalized in time. So no wonder time disappears. It's basically the Heisenberg principle applied to these two conjugate variables, one the constant, the other one the time. If I fix the constant, time disappears from the picture. Okay, so what happens? So let me continue with this. So this is why I'm going to be able to make contact with this Chern-Simon state. Now let's look at the connection representation. So I could be doing this in a metric representation, and then I would end up with the Hartle-Hawking and things like that. But here, let me do this now using the connection representation. And here, this is the point. I basically, by having put the Hamiltonian in this format, I can actually redefine a variable in terms of B, in terms of which my spatial solutions for these monochromatic waves are actually plane waves. Okay, so anyone who knows about Chern-Simons immediately will see that this is basically the reason why I chose this format for the Hamiltonian constraint. The alpha here is not really, lambda, is one over lambda. And the X is not B, obviously. It's a function of B, which is the Chern-Simons. And in fact, this is what I wrote here. So this is exactly what happens if I impose W equals minus one. So I basically put the Hamiltonian constraint, which was this one for lambda, in this form. My natural alpha is 3/lambda. That's the thing which, in a form, in a way, makes the dispersion relations in mini superspace linearized. And this guy here basically it tells you what the X should be, what the X of B should be, and it's this one, it's a Chern-Simon state. So this is really kind of just a way to find, these changes of variables are just a way of finding plane waves. So you find the right variables for having plane waves, except I generalize these. So for example, if I did this game with gravitational constant and radiation, instead of the Chern-Simons functional, I would have these functions instead. And funnily enough, these things have actually been found recently. There are some metric representation solutions for radiation. And in fact, these are the Fourier transforms. So in a way, these guys here are nothing but another way to represent well-known solutions in metric representation, but in the space of the metric. Okay, but this is more importantly than this. So this is just a trick to make the spatial bit simple. But more importantly, the full solution now is what happens when you, in addition to these spatial solutions, you now put the factor, this factor here, which is actually the evolution. The evolution, which is unitarian, obviously, of this guy in terms of this time. So you end up with plane waves. So the monochromatic solutions are actually plane waves, which have dispersion in terms of the original variables, your lambda, for example, or your gravitational constant and your B. But in terms of these X and these T's, which I define this way, and these alphas, they become plane waves. So this is the thing I didn't quite mention in the last, there was an aside there, I don't know if you noticed, but these X and alphas are a bit like linearizing variables in DSR, if you know what that is, except that this is in mini superspace. I'm basically borrowing a trick, which is very common in theories with the form dispersion relations, to make sure the dispersion relation in mini superspace is simplified or is written in a way that's simple.
So Zhao, can I ask you something right now? So I just want to see where you're going with this. So you have a wave function, which is a function of, I guess, BT and alpha, or I guess you put alpha separately from BNT. Why do you do that?
Yeah, you're always asking the question, which appears in the next slide.
Oh, sorry. Okay, let's see.
So where am I going? I'm going here. And what I'm going here is, okay, exactly. That's a very good question. You see the alpha disappear there. Okay. So again, two things. I gained the time variable. So I have evolution, right? But in addition to the time variable, now I expanded the space of solutions because my alpha now is not a constant set in stone, but it's something which is an integration constant, which of course in the quantum theory means I can superpose my plane waves with any amplitude I like, and I still solve the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay, this is where I'm going. And this is interesting because, okay, the Kodama state has been maligned, first of all, because this I wasn't there, right? So if you're not careful, if you work with the theory, which is not the real theory, you end up with something which is completely violates everything because it doesn't have this I here. Even when we have this I here, it's not normalizable in the usual sense. We have to invent crazy, or we have to invent hypothetical non-trivial inner products to say this is normalizable. Well, this is all normalizable with the trivial inner product, exactly the same way superpositions of plane waves are normalizable. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot more solutions, and this is where I'm going. It's actually very important. This is why I'm going to be able to make contact with observations. By the way, if I just took a plane wave, Kodama state, and I squared this with a trivial inner product, I get a uniform distribution in B. So what am I predicting? I'm not predicting anything. Whereas here, I actually have something which can be picked, right? So for example, I could have a coherent state in which I make this amplitude the square root of a normal distribution centered in a given constant. And immediately I get something which is my plane wave, but dressed with an exponential. Okay, and you'll see immediately that this thing is a function of x minus t. So I can, of course, this is a squeezed state. If I choose carefully these variants here, which could be anything, I can actually balance exactly the uncertainties between my constant and the time, and I end up with a semi-classical state. Okay, so very important because, in fact, I have a lot more solutions. So for example, I could just write a Hamiltonian constraint in this way. So I don't even need the plane waves. I could end up with a soliton, for example, okay? So I could have just a soliton, which is like a Gaussian in T minus X, oops, sorry, which immediately also from here suggests a conserved current and an interpretation, et cetera, et cetera. For example, Lee and I and a few other people played with quasi-topological theories. You actually find those solutions when the amplitude is a constant. So instead of having a delta function on a constant, you actually have a, you spread it completely all over the cosmological constant, which is what we did, and you end up with a light ray instead, okay? So instead of, a, you have all kinds of solutions here. They can be peaked, they can be non-peaked, they can be squeezed, they can be whatever, can be coherent. And this is the interesting thing, okay? So this is the basic proposal. Immediately the semi-classical states make contact with the real world because I have a time, okay? So time is not an illusion. The real world has a time. You can see what's happening. If I have a peak distribution, now the question is whether the peak follows the time. Any questions? I'm gonna be moving to a different part of the talk.
So I think maybe I want to get a little bit more clarity on what this means. So you see, you have this capital T and then you have capital X. So it was this capital T, the Chern-Simons time, or is this a part any time? Or I guess I'm still not sure. Okay,
I'm going to be answering all your questions, but maybe not immediately. So this time at this stage, at this point here, mm-hmm. this time is nothing but the conjugate of the constant. Okay.
Okay. So
I made the constant like an energy, and the conjugate is going to be a time, right? So that's all I did. Anyway, you're doing everything exactly like this is your time, okay? So so I said there was a Hamiltonian. So I think this probably answers your question. Yes. So this is the first Hamiltonian equation was the fact that the alpha was zero. The alpha was a constant. The second is basically the time formula. So the same thing. In fact, you can see the Meissner time appearing here. So if then lambda is minus one, this T dot goes like a cubed, right? So it's basically the volume time of Meissner. Mm-hmm. But in general, classically all the times are equivalent. The time is basically, your variable, which is the momentum of your constant, is gonna be one measure of time according to this formula. Now, the problem is of course quantum mechanically. I mean, that's the question we have to address, but classically you can show that the classical trajectory is given by these. You can show that the second Friedman equation follows from this, okay? And the first one. You basically, well, you already imposed the first one. So the second one, which is the classical trajectory, is basically the statement that my new x and my t represent the classical trajectory. So as long as I have a peaked function, and remember, I just show you here, that in general, my functions, my solutions are functions of t minus x. If this f is peaked, then the peak follows a classical trajectory. Except, of course, you're right. So what is t here? T starts its life here as being the conjugate of a constant. It's only via Hamilton equation it gets related to this expression. So you need something. And remember, there's a t here. There's an alpha there. The complementary variables quantum mechanically. So this happens all the time. For example, p dot and so on, and x dot. And so on average, this is always true quantum mechanically. That's the Herrenfest theorem. But in practice, you need a coherent state, minimizing the uncertainties in the conjugates for this to be approximately true. So I have immediately contact. It's the Aristotelian view. Time is not an illusion. I need something which at least makes some contact with the real world in the proper way. This does so. Okay, and of course I needed the time to do that. So comment on Chern-Simons time, thank you. So you asked all the questions. In this case, you asked the question, not only the next slide, but in the next two slides. Thank you, Niyayesh, you're being a prompt here. Okay, so so there is, there's a lot of contact. And I think, interestingly here, in this paper, Yanu and Teitelboim, they identified time as the conjugate of lambda. So could be one over lambda. So this time is basically, once you have a lambda conjugate, you can make a function of that, and it's just a canonical transformation, right? So here, the time was identified as the conjugate of lambda. Here was identified as the Chern-Simons function. So in fact, there's not really a contradiction, okay? I think basically what I'm saying is that this Chern-Simons function is not a time variable, it's a spatial variable. Time instead is a conjugate of lambda. But it just so happens that the two can be confused because the peak of the wave function follows this outgoing light ray, okay? So I think this answers your question, Ayesha. This is not Chern-Simons time. It ends up being, in practice, the Chern-Simons time.
Mm-hmm.
But only when I have a peak distribution, and that peak actually is following the classical trajectory because there is this identification.
Okay, but so can you then remind us, so let's say you're saying this is only valid on shell based, I guess that's what maybe another way. When you were satisfied classical equations of motion, X is T, but in general, they're independent of each other.
And what's even worse, I mean, I could, for example, go back here. For example, imagine I take a soliton. Soliton follows, the peak follows the right thing. But for example, for a soliton, this is no longer true, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a soliton would be a disaster because the soliton is very well fixed in T, but not in alpha, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you need the bits inside your well-defined function in T to actually get something like this, which makes sense classically.
Right. Okay. So can you remind us what is X is in the cosmology? What is X? Is it like, was it Hubble or something? I forgot, what, capital X.
The X is the thing which makes these, well, it's the thing which is the Chern-Simons for lambda equals minus one, for W equals minus one. So it's the thing which, it's the thing which makes this plane wave, a plane wave, right? So in general, I have dispersion in the Hubble. Mm-hmm. This is like a linearizing variable. The X,
mm-hmm.
which in the case of cosmological constant is just a Chern-Simons. In the case of radiation, is this expression, etc., etc.
Okay, thanks.
Okay,
but I have one question. So, is there any restriction on which constant alpha you can take, and in particular, any restriction regarding its mass dimension?
Sorry, I didn't understand. Is there any what?
Restriction, like a constraint. You can take any alpha that you like is there any constraint regarding, for instance, its mass dimension?
Oh, no. In that case, basically, I'm not looking at that. No. So I'm basically just looking at whatever is useful. But remember, this is an effective procedure, right? I'm not saying this is fundamental or anything. Mm-hmm. I'll just look at the bit of phase space in which I can put a Hamiltonian approximately in that position, and that's it. I get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
The only constraint is being useful. Okay, that's all there is to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so where am I? Okay, am I here? I made contact with the real world. okay, right. So let me just move on to the bit which things are going to become funny, of course, because. You end up with a time, end up with contact with, so in this case, of course, there'll be different epochs, but in different epochs, I use different times. But remember, we end up in a situation, in a picture, in which fundamentally, so I've been saying that none of this is fundamental. Fundamentally, we end up in a land of plenty of times, because if I play this game fundamentally with the Schrodinger, with the Hamiltonian, then your Schrodinger equation is really a PDE in multiple concurrent times. And it just so happens that in some regions of phase space, some of them are more important than others. But it's even worse than that, okay? Even it's not enough to say that some regions of phase space, the other alphas become subdominant. The question is also about the general solution. The general solution can be very complex. So in this case, I've made the alpha, and if you can see this, these alphas and these t's now are both phase. So I'm just considering not one at a time, as I did. I assumed each I was dominant, each ingredient was dominant first. Now I'm just going to be looking at the whole thing as one big vector of constants. So I end up with something which in general is this mess, okay? So I have a spatial thing here, depending on a vector there. It's true that I can have these monochromatic waves, but I can also have amplitudes, which can be very complicated. So in particular, these amplitudes don't need to factorize, okay? So this can be really, even if I'm lucky enough to live in a space in which different regions pick one constant, then I have to be very careful with the states I build, okay? And the point here is that you can build states which give you semi-classical multi-time situations. So you have to insist on the fact that the A's are normal distributions like the ones I said before, so coherent states, but also factorize. And then it's not difficult to see that what happens that in some areas, then this guy becomes the, this guy is a need to becomes one of these functions I have before. Come on, I should have that this year. It's my easier. Okay, one of these guys regards to the actual guy that dominates, because that's what actually happens in that part of the phase space. Sorry about this. I shouldn't be doing this. It's terrible. Oops, now these all disappeared. Okay, what happened now? Right. So if you do that, then this guy becomes a piecewise plane wave in the different x alphas. So it's okay. I mean, as long as I pick, as long as I am lucky enough to have a Hamiltonian that separates one constant as the dominant constant in different regions. It's not just true that I have the semi-classical state and it's all cooled. Can you see me now? He's complaining about my internet. Okay.
I think you got slowed down for a minute, or not a minute, a few seconds, and then, but we have it now.
Yeah. Okay, good. So all that happens here is that you essentially pass from one time dominating one region to another time dominating another region, and all that is good. The problem is exactly, so I've assumed a lot about the Hamiltonian. I've assumed a lot about the states. The problem is that there could be alternative states to these ones. And this is where I'm going to be completely speculative. I'm going to be finishing with this. And I'm not going to apologize for this either. I mean, I think the fact that there are states which do not give you the semi-classical limit is not something you should apologize for. Against tradition, I've already made contact with observations, okay, in quantum gravity, but now I can also predict new phenomenology precisely because those states do exist. So this is the last bit of the talk. This is work in progress. I'm actually working. Some of these, I'm doing this with Chris Eichen, which is quite funny because Chris is very mathematical and I'm very anti-mathematical. So this is going to be an entertaining collaboration. All I want is something which somehow, one way or another, predicts an observation, which is controversial. I mean, so it's clear that I could have a state or one set of states which give me the semi-classical limit. That's it, fine. Okay, I made contact with observations, but that's not very falsifiable. So it's actually the fact that I have these alternative states that I think makes this falsifiable, therefore interesting. So for example, I assume non-factorizability. So what if I have entangled constants? So what if I have a state in which the constants appear in a way that they don't actually factorize? So this amplitude then will clearly leave a hangover of the previous time phase in the new one. Okay, and that's one thing which could be very interesting to see if the one way or another there will be observational implications from this. That's the first speculation. The second one is, okay, imagine I have, well, the universe looks very classical so far. So imagine something which is a coherent factorizable state in all the constants that have been dominant up to now. But what about the one that's coming next around the corner, which is the cosmological constant? So in fact, let's imagine that I have something which is coherent factorizable in everything, in Gs, in Cs, in everything, but not in lambda. And in fact, imagine is, for example, a plane wave in lambda, completely delocalized in time. So this is quite funny because, you know, basically you're saying quantum cosmology could be not in the Planck epoch, but just around the corner. And there could be implications. And of course, now the question is that you cannot make this too dramatic. Otherwise, this would be clearly wrong. But it could also be very interesting.
Sorry, Ja, but what about the coherence?
Well, you know what? I'm not sure. So, and I really don't. Some people believe that the universe decohered the day the microwave background was observed. I find that so laughable. So I'm actually saying, what if the universe is actually a coherent state now?
Well, I mean, you could certainly construct a simple coherent set, but usually as soon as you introduce interactions, then you get something that's really, I mean, the coherence happens very rapidly.
This is a huge, I mean, this is the whole universe. What interaction with what?
But I mean, if you're just doing a homogeneous universe, there's no observable. And I mean, I don't think there's much to discuss. But if you're talking about observables, there must be, I mean, inhomogeneities. And then, of course,
I have observables. And in fact, this is the point. I mean, this B is an observable. It's actually the Hubble factor, right? As a function of time, right? So it is actually something. So this has actually a line. There's one prediction here, which is the Hubble factor, right?
No, I mean, it is an observable in a mathematical sense. But in a physical sense, you don't live in an homogeneous universe.
So I think you can always find those things. I'm just saying, I don't believe in the collapse of the wave function in this context. I'm very happy to have a coherent state. You can even discuss things like the variance of this, right? So the variance is minimal, right, by the way. But I mean, the variance is constant in B, in X, but not in B. Mm-hmm. And when you transpose this to B, then it's really tiny, right? So we would be in a very, very classical state if we are in these coherence factorizable guys. So the question is, what if we're not? Mm-hmm. That's a good question, but I don't lose sleep over the coherence in this context. I don't know. Maybe you do. Maybe you're afraid someone is going to look at the universe. And
well, I mean, it's not about observers. It's just about interactions. And
this is the whole set of interactions. I mean, in a way, this, yeah, then you have another issue about the next level up, blah, 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 everything. So, I mean, you could say that about, I guess, okay. Okay, this is actually completely independent. This would be the easy way out for this talk, is just to say, well, this is all happening in the early universe. I don't care. I don't like that. I mean, what if it's now? Quantum cosmology could be now, could be here and now, right? What happened?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's certainly a good question. And I don't want to stop your momentum. We should just carry on. Yeah, but I'm just saying that's the usual answer. People will say
I'm just completely speculating, so it doesn't really matter. In fact, I was going to say even crazier things. Okay. So the other crazy thing is, of course, you're going to find this even worse. Okay. So if you solve the horizon problem, then of course you pass the same beat twice, right? Mm-hmm. Because of course, first you leave the horizon, then you enter the horizon. So of course, you pass the same beat at different times, but and of course, what I said is true, but the same B is going to have two wave functions passing through it with different times. And of course, what I said is true separately when you square, but there's an interference term. So very good question. I don't know if this is, would there be decoherence? Would there be interference, I would say, between the different times? I have no idea. I think it's a good question. You can ask this even for two dominating questions in the same period, actually. But maybe the worst thing, well, this is basically my who cares, you know, my slide, you know. I think the novelty of this proposal is exactly in these crazy ideas. And maybe they're not there. Maybe one way out is exactly to say that we live in a very boring state, or maybe we collapsed, but this is definitely a possibility. And a funny one is, of course, we live in interesting times in many different ways. But you see, quantum mechanics, I mean, what I said was what happens when constant dominates. But in fact, with regards to everything I said, the current phase of the universe is actually very special in two ways. Okay, the first one is actually we have ingredients with different equations of state coexisting right now. Okay, so we are exactly witnessing the handover of one kind of clock to another kind of clock. So this is crazy, right? So if there's any kind of thing which might be wrong when you go from one clock to another, we should be witnessing it. And as if this is not enough, we're actually witnessing a bounce, which is what I tried to, for some shock value, told you right at the start. We have just moved from a region with W bigger than minus a third matter, W equals zero, to the regime where W is smaller than minus a third. So we have a bounce in B. So not only the thing I said about passing the same B twice, in fact, we just kind of ricocheted off a wall in B, which is crazy. So no idea, but I have some kind of early calculations. It looks like everything doesn't look like it's going to leave a big effect unless you have a crazy state. Not really obvious what happens during the crossover. So it doesn't matter. I'm running out of time and I don't want to overrun. You can actually do this, for example, with radiation and the cosmological constant and see what happens at the crossover. Doesn't look very serious. I mean, I think I'll finish here. Lots of questions, I think, during the talk. I didn't want to overrun, but I think this is the right time. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Joao. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great talk. Okay, so we have time for some more questions. So please feel free just to unmute to ask anything. Or have we already asked all the questions during the talk?
I mean, I can keep going, but I think someone else should probably say something.
Now you shut up for a bit, will you?
I mean, I will try, but if nobody stops me other than you, you cannot stop me.
Yeah, no, it's impossible to stop.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this last bit, you went a bit too fast. What are you trying to do? I think I missed maybe the slide before the one, before the last slide. If you go just before this.
I didn't want to, is it this one? So this one is, Mm-hmm. So this one is reasonably easy. It's basically if you take something like, which is not the realistic one, right? So this is actually the radiation one. So this is a transition from radiation to cosmological constant. In a way, this is more relevant to inflation and then after reheating, right? Mm-hmm. You see, I was expecting something like a production of particles. Mm-hmm. Crazy now, but it doesn't really happen. And part of the problem is that if you do this game of writing the Hamiltonian in this format, right? Then what happens if the B transform, the B actually depends on lambda and M, right, in this transition. So you end up with the right regimes when, so what happens is basically you write it this way and you end up with plus and minus, the plus is the radiation epoch, sorry, the lambda epoch, the minus is the, mm-hmm. yeah, I forgot which is which. But you basically end up with, you don't actually have a hangover from one phase to another. You can just see this in the right limits. These things just basically give you the right wave functions in the two limits. So there's no particle production. There's no like memory of this transition. But the thing which is curious is what actually happens when you're sitting right in the middle, right? So it's basically, the question is what happens now if now I'm about to go from one time to another, would you actually see this observational? So this is the kind of thing I'm trying to solve without much success at the moment.
So you're saying that there are two, this time, there are two kind of branches, and then there's a crossover from one branch to another branch, and you think that might be an interesting...
No, this is the, so we're basically here, like we're basically at this G0 at the moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is where, so your B, it was increasing, you know, matter epoch, and now it's decreasing, right? So we just turn around from one to the other. Right. So this plus and minus just represents the fact that the B was increasing and now is decreasing. So you have two regimes in which this B is much bigger than this, but you know, they're both basically, one is like coming from the matter epoch, the other one is going into the lambda epoch.
Mm-hmm.
This is just simple algebra. Now just, I picked this example because it's easy to find out. You basically can solve this quadratic very easily in this case.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Can you propose experiments that can test these ideas?
Well, that's the idea, but first of all, we have to do the calculation. So I would say, for example, what happens, what constraint do I have about the wave function of the universe in terms of lambda not being a coherent state? I mean, how would we see this? I mean, basically you'd say, imagine that actually it's a plane wave, okay? So we're about to go into a plane wave in lambda. This would mean completely localization, right? So I see a lead disappear there, so I can say horrible things about him, okay? That's good. A few years back, Lee and I had this idea that there's something wrong with the universe having a timeline going continuously, and because this creates this infinite regress problem. So what if actually, you know, this infinite tower of turtles in time is the result of the fact you lose the time variable at some point? So even for you, John, this should be completely crazy. This is some kind of stuff I did with Lee a while ago. Now, the very good question is, of course, in a situation like this, imagine that now I have something which, not terrible, this. Something in which these guys here are not, so everything which concerns the radiation epoch and the matter epoch is this of this form, but then imagine I have a delta function in lambda, for example. How would I see this? This would be pretty dramatic for the what actually happens to the universe when it becomes lambda dominated, right? But the question is, would I see this now in the transition period, for example?
Yeah, I think the problem is you're showing your questions, but it's not clear what we should be thinking about. What should we look at? Like, is there be a signature? Is there going to be a signature on CMB? What sort of signature? what are you?
Well, I mean, the thing that would be the most obvious one is just to write the the average. This is all municipal space, right? So the question is, what would be the correction for the average of, for example, the Hubble as a function of time? You know, what would this be? Well, that's a very good question, because maybe this doesn't make any sense, because you're basically losing the description of H as a function of T in a situation like that.
Yeah, so
I want it to be a bit, you know, facetious. I would say the Hubble tension is exactly the fact that you're basically looking at two complementary variables, and it's somehow the Heisenberg principle is kicking in. Which would only be true if the thing was widely non-coherent, right? The coherent state just minimizes the thing, and it's really not the way to do it. And of course, I mean, what you're going to say is, you know, would this be like a collapse of the wave function? I don't know. I think this would be, there's a question of interpretation at this point, clearly. Mm-hmm. You think the world is classical? I'm actually not so sure. But then the question is, how would you bridge these wave functions with the observables you'd be seeing, you'd be testing?
Right, yeah. Cool, thanks.
Yeah, so we are like a bit over time. So why don't we stop here? So thanks again, Joao, for a great talk.